Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Oh, welcome in. You are listening to the weekend edition of the KE Report. My name is Corey Fleck, and I'm your host for the first hour. In the first hour, we are going to focus a fair bit on the U.S. equity markets and that almost continued melt-up that we keep on seeing, especially at the end of the week. But we are also going to dive a little bit into the resource sector. As always, for all the listeners on the radio, I highly recommend downloading our podcast or coming to our website, kereport.com, and listening to the full segments that get posted in the weekend show posting due to radio restrictions. I just can't fit all that content into those radio segments. So again, you can get those full interviews on our website and podcast. I am kicking off this weekend show with Rick Bensignor. Rick writes the Bensignor Investment Strategies. I really always have time for what Rick has to say. And Rick, where we're going to start here is on the U.S. equity markets. You have been on board for this rally on these U.S. markets, even when it was starting to get a little extended or people were saying it had gone on for too long. You were on this show saying there's still more room for these markets to move up. And at the tail end of this week, the S&P finished on Friday over 2900. It moved up over 0.5% just on Friday alone. What do you think? Is it finally run its course, these U.S. equity markets, or is there still more upside here?
Well, Corey, first of all, thanks for having me on again. I always enjoy talking with you too. To answer the question, do I think there's more to go? I think there probably is. And the way I've got clients positioned is that for long short books, and for me to explain that to perhaps the non-Wall Street listener, lots of hedge funds set their kind of structure up to be both long stocks and short stocks, generally in the same sector, such that they take the market direction out of the picture. It's simply through analysis, betting that stock A will do better than stock B. And as an example, if you were, let's say, long Coca-Cola and short Pepsi, or long Home Depot and short Lowe's, those are natural pair trades. They're in the same space. And then if you have a long and short position on at the same time with two stocks that are very similarly related, it matters less which way the whole market moves and becomes more important on just which one will rally more in an up market or which one will go down less in a down market. So a lot of hedge funds are structured that way. For those, we've been long all year and continue to tell them to stay net long. And these funds don't have to be zeroed out in exposure. In other words, they don't have to have $100 long for every $100 short. They often can minimally play a direction to the market if they think the market generally is going to go higher. Their book will, they'll have more long exposure on than they'll have short exposure. And that's what we've been telling them. So for the entire year, we've been more long than short in long short books. And that's what makes up a large portion of hedge funds out there. For the long only crowd, which is the mutual funds, essentially long only is another way of saying a fund that needs to be invested almost 100% all the time. We've been nonstop long with them. Only for tactical traders did we lighten up near 2800. And so for the last 100 points, we haven't had a bias other than the market is generally moving higher. And I don't have any reason to tell you to be short, but I've also in the last 2 weeks gotten cautiously bullish, meaning I'm still bullish, but you know, with more caution now. So less willing to commit new long capital into the market versus riding the profits and the longs that we've already gotten you into over the last several months. So in general, do I think the market can still move higher? I do. I'll tell you, the most of the fundamental stories that have been out there for why you should be concerned that potentially next year or the year after a recession is coming, whether it's inverted yield curve and all the other things that the bears have been touting, what I would say is it's the same story they've been saying all year. So for the three and a half months that 2019 has already been happening and it has occurred, most of the bears have been bearish all along. And maybe their story pans out and maybe not, but they've certainly missed 300 to 400 points up in the S&P, which I don't want to do. So, and I don't think I'd be serving clients trying to estimate and give all the reasons why a recession is at hand or could happen at any moment or sometime next year and why you shouldn't be in stocks, because we have very defined levels also that if stocks get under certain, if the S&P gets under certain levels, we definitely want to lighten up exposure. So I rather play for the bull market that is at hand. The bull market that, as far as we told our clients, never went away in December. We have no evidence in any of the models we look at that the S&P or NASDAQ went into bear markets the way the press would have told you, because the S&P got 20% down in December from its all-time high, and NASDAQ got 23%. But the models we used did not say or indicate that we had actually entered a bear market. So by early January, and I think I mentioned this a month ago or so, the last time I was on your show, is that by early January, we told our clients that the December bottom at Christmas time was not just a good trading low for the S&P, but actually the low for all major global equity indices. And that's the call that was probably the most important call I've made this year, because it has kept us long for virtually the entire move up. We simply missed 1.25% on one tactical short that was near 2,800 and or just beneath, I think, 2,782 is where we shorted, and we paid 2,917 or 18, something like that. So a little over a percent we lost, and that's it. Otherwise, I've been long, I continue to be long, and I'm not worried that the market's going to have a significant sell-off, nor that we would in any way, shape, or form test the December lows. I just don't see it. And I think that the amount of people on the street who have been saying bear market because of that December sell-off, that's the perfect case of the market faking out people and getting them to lean the wrong way before the truer move would take place. And this is, you know, this is not a one-time only occurrence in markets. This happens many times. And in this case, all you have to do is look at a chart over the last 6 months and what the market's done. And despite the week and a half sell-off going into the Christmas low that was severe and strong and quick, it's been straight up since. And anybody who clings to it's a bear market, I mean, we're less than, a percent or so, percent and a half away from all-time highs. How do you say it's a bear market? And yet I still see people quoted in the press and on, you know, the business television stations who are still carrying on about a bear market, that we're in it and this is the dead cat bounce. Well, this is one heck of a dead cat bounce, if that's what it is.
We do continue to hear a lot of that negativity around, and you're right, a lot of this negativity still has been predicated on these same few excuses, but the fact of the matter is, just this year, the S&P up about 15%. That's a big move for the first 3.5 months. One other thing to consider here, and it's something that I think you're alluding to, is that it's a game that a lot of people play, trying to pick the tops or trying to pick the bottoms in markets, but that's a dangerous game. The strategy of understanding momentum and seeing the trades and momentum carrying markets in certain directions, you really shouldn't be trying to play that other game where you're picking almost extremes, tops and bottoms. Can you discuss this strategy?
It's a great question, and I will advise your listeners that what you just said is the way they should think about markets, which is you're not generally going to have the skill or the models or consistent ability to do that. Frankly, and this is specifically to me alone, professionally as a Wall Streeter for 37 years in some very high-level positions, it's actually how doing what you said we shouldn't do is actually how I made my name and reputation on the street. I actually do tend to play not in the first standard deviation of price action, the fat part of the bell curve, but I actually try to play for the tails. And it's a much more difficult game. And I will tell you that, you know, the average listener in the public should not and cannot do it because they don't have access to models that are designed to be able to do that. On the institutional side, I do, and it costs me plenty of money to have software that can do this. But I actually consistently, not always, and look, I get plenty of trade ideas wrong, but here's an example. Late November, I tell people my most bullish call is get long China. And China's still falling apart. The world, everywhere but the S&P, or everywhere but the U.S. was falling apart for all of 2018. And I think it was the last week in November, I tell people that you really should start looking into China. And I note it as my most bullish call of anything that I'm doing. Now, you know, I get pushback from clients and the things that it's falling apart. You're crazy. Da, da, da. Look at the China's up, what, 20 or 30% since then. It's a style I have. And I say this in the sense that it is very difficult to do with consistency. But 37 years of experience in focusing mostly on trying to call market turns is what I do. But you as the host of the show and the voice that people hear week in, week out, I couldn't agree with you more that it is not what people should be doing in general, and that, you know, identifying a trend and trying to play the trend for as long as they can is the way to make money over time.
Now, one more quick comment, too, regarding the market moves, just not in the U.S., but also that move over in the Chinese markets. How much is this predicated on a shift in central bank policy and also the People's Bank of China loosening up a lot of liquidity and a lot of money for that money to, assumingly, go into the markets?
Well, look, it all that helps, because if the PBOC is going to keep money liquid, And in an easing fashion after PMI numbers, and PMI numbers is purchasing managers index numbers. And typically when it's under 50, it's considered bearish. And China went into a long period of time where PMI numbers were under 50. And you'd seen the effect in just how much their markets had sold off. The fact that the government is willing to put out easy money is certainly going to help. The thing is, when that became public was well after the lows were put in place. And that's why, to me, because of the way I look at markets, if I can identify potential low-risk turning points in the market, where if I'm wrong, I'll lose a little bit because it's still just going the way it's going. But if I'm right, I can pick a turn before it's obvious. Then now, if you look at charts of China, you go, well, look, they have easing and this thing's rocked to the upside. It looks like it's on a turnaround. That's when everybody else jumps on board and pushes the market in the same direction that I'm already positioned in from much lower. And that to me is how I exploit the marketplace and how I beat the computers and the algorithms, is being able to pick turns that they don't know how to do. And the whole goal for me is to be able to pick the turns before they're obvious to everyone else. Because once they're obvious, you haven't done any good.
Yeah, that's true. Interesting comments there, Rick. Let's also talk about the bond market too, because yields, especially let's say the 10-year, really been hit hard ever since the market started to fall. We can look back to October when the 10-year was about 3.25, and ever since then it's been down, 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 except for the last 2 weeks when it bounced very interestingly off that, I believe, 200-week moving average at 23.56, and now yields have moved up even at the tail end of the week. We saw still that continued move up. You can make the argument that the 10-year is still very much down at the bottom part of this trading range, but what are your comments on the swings that we've seen in the bond market?
So look, the early part of the year, the lows, in fact, I think it was January 1st, or well, 1st we're close, so January 2nd, we had gotten down to 2.55%. And then I'm pretty sure that's when it had happened, yields had moved up the rest of the time. Now, it may be off on the date there, but I remember that 2.55 was the low of the move. Then when they broke under 255 recently, especially on the flip-flop of the Fed and Powell saying that we're not going to have rate cuts, I saw far too many people get bullish quickly. And we had a downside target in rates at 2.344%. And we got to 2.356. So literally, you know, one basis point, one 100th of a percent is we got to our target, and I immediately told clients, if you're playing for yields to keep going lower, I would take that off, or at minimum take half off, because hitting this downside target as quickly as we did once we broke 255, it was all a matter of 2 weeks. And over the last couple of weeks, we've bounced right back. I think today we closed just around 2.56, so we're kind of right at that inflection point in bonds where we've rallied back in yields to where it had been the low. And I'm in the camp, and in my outlook for 2019 was that yields would stay between 2.4 and 3% for the bulk of the year. So having just come out of the bottom end of that down 5 extra basis points to 235 and immediately jumping to 255-ish says to me that I think I'm probably right about that being the lower end. And therefore, I don't really want to be long bonds and think that, you know, look, we could get back up to 2.8, 2.9 just because of how much one-sided the market went too quickly. So if we get much higher from here, I think we probably go test 2.8 and get towards, you know, the higher levels of this year. And that doesn't mean that the market or Powell is going to do anything different. It just means there's a trading game behind all this stuff too. It's not just the fundamentals. I frequently tell people, fundamentals, you got to know what they are and they'll drive the picture long term. But they only make up half of why stuff moves at any given time or day, and the other half is the behavioral side of the market. It's all the psychology, and it's how people are positioned, and it's where their own individual pain kicks in relative to where they are positioned in the market. I had just done a whole 1-hour seminar presentation last Friday at the CMT Annual Symposium, which is a group of market technicians who get together every year. And I did an entire talk about this whole subject of to be able to figure out where investors are collectively anchored. In other words, where's the average pain point or pleasure point in the market at any given time? And if you can figure that out, once the market starts moving away from that level, then you've got plenty of people in the pain. And people in pain will act much more emotionally than people who have pleasure. And therefore, that's just another one of the ways that I can, whether it's through my individual investor newsletter, which is called In the Note Trader, and it's available, you can find out more at inthenotetrader.com, or my institutional clients who I talk to. It comes from the basis of the analysis is the same in the sense that I'm looking to exploit the very fragile, irrational human mind that exists in every human being and plays markets. And so there are times and places that you can more clearly be able to tell when what collectively the masses think are going to happen is not likely to happen. And that's exactly why down in the mid 2.3s in the 10-year yield, I was telling people, cover this trade.
No, that all makes a lot of sense too. And hey, Rick, I've been reading along with your comments and you've been very accurate so far. So I always respect what you have to say. Let's also wrap it up with some comments on commodities. So let's first talk about oil. Oil went through a very rough Q4, but has since bounced back. It's not back to the levels where it started to fall back in October, but still a nice recovery in the oil market. I'm getting a lot of back and forth saying we're entering a seasonally slow time for oil. Everything seems to have been going in oil's favor with OPEC continuing to cut production. What do you think? Where does oil stand in your book?
So I am negative oil, both technically here in the low 60s, as well as fundamentally. And I don't often talk about fundamentals because I'm not generally a fundamental strategist. In October, when I was on interviewed on TV and I was talking about that oil, at that point, oil had fallen from 72, and I don't know, maybe then it was down in the mid 50s or so. I don't remember exactly where it was. But what ultimately it went to $42.50 a barrel. And now it's pretty much been straight up since. And to me, no commodity moves from percentage terms, when you think about what the move is from 77 down to 42 and change is, without something major league going on. So I have not been playing the bull part, and it was a significant move, right? So from Christmas time, I mean, the oil chart and the S&P chart are virtually identical. They both topped just about October 1st. They both bottomed the day before Christmas, and they've both been screaming to the upside since. So oil in the stock market should not be that correlated the way it is, but that's how they've been trading. Up here in oil, I think this is the eighth or ninth inning of this rally in oil. I don't think we're going to see $70 oil again, Corey. And I think that from here at, where are we, in the 63 handle, close to 64. So let's say from roughly $64 oil, the next $6, and I could even say the next $10 is down, because I don't see oil going to 70 again. I'm willing to be wrong because, you know, look, this is a guessing game. But best case scenario, I think oil could possibly get is about $67. So anywhere from here on up for the next few dollars, I'm looking to find places to get short oil. And I do think, you know, whether you want to look at it in $6 terms or $10 terms, that next move is down.
Okay. Let's wrap it up, too, with some comments on the precious metals. Gold continues to be range-bound, but we've seen a couple divergences in platinum and palladium over the last few months. Care to share some of your strategies here?
Yeah, so platinum, I got bullish at 830. I saw the big spread between gold and platinum, and it just felt as if gold had, you know, generally been moving up off of last summer's lows, platinum far less so. But I was thinking about that if the economy ends up being decent, platinum has industrial use. Obviously, you know, we all know it's part of the catalytic converter in a car. Gold has very little industrial use. So I thought that if the economy was going to pick up, platinum could certainly do better than gold. The hedge for gold wouldn't be as needed. So I chose to get long platinum. I also got short palladium, and this has been ripping to the upside. It is now, in fact, the most precious of precious metals. It is priced higher than any other one. And just a month ago, it's in the $1,300 range now, but just a month ago, palladium was as high as $1,550 or so. And I was fortunate I got short at $1,521 and used that as a pair trade against long platinum, short palladium. And it worked. You know, when you do a pair trade, you don't expect both sides to work out. You just want the one, you know, one of the, if you're short B and you're long A, you just want one side to do better than the other, and you'll make money. In this case, palladium fell $200 and platinum rallied $50 to $70. So both sides of the trade worked, and it's been a home run trade. So I like platinum. It's stalling here at 900. It got to 920 earlier this week. It's hanging out near 900, but I think ultimately platinum can get towards 1,000. So I took half of my platinum off. I think it was yesterday, and I'll put some back on if we pull back a little bit, but I think platinum's got room to go. So that's my precious metal of choice right now.
Okay. We're going to wrap it up there. Hey, Rick, it's always great having you on the show. I appreciate you taking some time. If anybody wants more information on Rick's newsletter, you can search the website that he recommended earlier or simply email me, fleck@kereport.com, and I am happy to put you in touch with the right people, Rick included. Rick, thanks again for taking some time, and have a great weekend, my friend.
You too, Corey. Thanks so much.
Al Corlin's firm, A.B. Corlin & Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout. Your weekly fix on finance and investing. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
Oh, welcome back. Continuing to listen to the first hour of the weekend edition. I hope everybody enjoyed the conversation I just had with Rick Bensinger. I have to say he has been pretty spot on in terms of the broad averages and how that recovery has gone on longer than most people have thought. But Rick has been on board with a lot of that recovery. In this segment, I am chatting with Adrian Day. He is the CEO of Adrian Day Asset Management. And Adrian, we will get into some of the resource companies that you like and that have been performing pretty well. But first, I want to follow up on that conversation I had with Rick, and that is the strength generally in the broad averages. The broad markets continue to do quite well. While they haven't quite reached all-time highs, we are seeing certain sectors perform quite well. One sector that you have outlined to us before with a couple stocks you've been looking at are dividend stocks. And quite frankly, when we have a market like we do right now with low and declining rates, dividend stocks benefit. Can you share some of your recent strategies in terms of the broad averages first?
Yeah, absolutely. And thank you for having me, Corey. Now, I'm sorry I haven't listened yet, obviously. By its nature, I haven't listened to the previous interview. So I'm not quite, you know, I hope I don't contradict or repeat something he said. But yeah, I think the main thing about the broad averages to remember is that the U.S. economy is still doing relatively well compared with the rest of the world. U.S. interest rates are still very attractive relative to the rest of the developed world. And so the U.S. remains, and the U.S. markets remain, a prime destination for global investors. Add to that, of course, there's no shortage of money around. The Fed has been printing money like crazy for the last, 11 years. And there's no shortage of money. So, you know, I'm a fundamentalist. I look at valuations. But we also have to remember other things like psychology and just, frankly, how much money is available to go into the market. And at the moment, there's no shortage. So, you know, we saw that big sell-off at the end of last year, primarily because of continued Fed tightening, so-called tightening. I put tightening in quotes. When the Fed this year repeatedly said that, you know, we're probably done with raising rates for the time being, Powell, the Fed chairman, said there has to be a reason for us to raise rates going forward. That tells us that the bias is towards easing. And I, like most people, I think, suspect that the next move in interest rates later this year will be down, not up. So, you know, so people obviously came back into the stock market. Now, you know, you mentioned there's obviously the whole market's doing well. You mentioned one sector in particular, the business development companies. These are companies that lend money to small businesses. I've been a big fan of this sector for a long time because, you know, the yields tend to be very attractive for retail investors. The stocks can be volatile, but if you're buying these stocks for the income and you have a long-term view, what I say to people is just ignore the volatility. You know, if you get 7 or 8%, and you get 7 or 8% on an annual basis for the next 10 or 15 years, it doesn't really matter whether the stock goes up or down or what in the meantime. Obviously, you need to look carefully at the individual companies. What are they investing in? You know, are they first lien, second lien, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. The most important thing for people to look at, I think, is the dividend covered by earnings, and the metrics that these companies use is net operating income. So is it covered by, we can call it earnings if you want, but is it covered by earnings or is it covered by net income, net investment income, rather? That's the important thing. You don't want a company that's paying a dividend out of capital, because they'll have to cut it at some point. But, you know, I mentioned when we were chatting earlier, one of my favorites is a company called Glasson Investment. And, you know, I mentioned how these stocks have done very well recently. This was trading under $9 at the end of the year, now trading $12.30, basically. So it's had a really good run this year. It was obviously, the whole sector was particularly depressed at the end of last year on the tightening, because as interest rates move up, companies that are basically dividend payers and the people buy for the dividend obviously become less attractive, just like bonds go down when interest rates go up. Now that interest rates have stabilized and look as though they might be heading down, people have come back into this sector. So it all makes logical sense. But I mentioned the big run in the stock. It's now selling at the high price since 2008. So a lot of investors might say, well, yeah, I'm not sure I want to look at that. I want to buy that at this point. And you know me well enough, Corey, to know that I don't like chasing stock prices. So we miss out on quite a lot because we don't chase stock prices. But you look at this company, it's yielding well over 7%. And that's covered by their net income that they earn on both the loans that they make and also on equity kickers that they get. So if you can get 7.5% on a solid company where the dividend, has increased, it will increase, they've already announced it in June of this year, and then in September of last year, and then in March of last year. So you can see that the dividend, not only is it covered by income, but it has consistently and repeatedly increased. I mean, as they say, what's not to like? If you want income, what's wrong with buying this now, knowing that in a market sell-off, the stock might come down a bit, but the dividend will still be paid? And very quickly, another one, if I may, is Ares Capital. I mean, Ares, which is the largest of these BDCs, it's about a $6 billion market cap, $7 billion market cap. But their dividend is an astonishing 9.1%, fully covered by net income. And they also have just increased the dividend twice last year. And they've also paid additional special cash dividends. These are dividends that have already been announced but haven't been paid yet. So this year, they will be paying an extra 8 cents in four different dividends. On a company that has a 39-cent quarterly dividend, an extra 8 cents is meaningful. So we're looking at a better than 9% dividend yield. Again, you know, if you're looking for income, that's tough to beat. Sorry, Corey, I answered that rather more extensively than you probably expected.
You know what, Adrian, you did outline a couple companies there that are showing a nice dividend, plus their stocks are also moving, so you do get that potential of capital gains. What I think this is telling a broader story, though, is of where investors are starting to look. In all fairness, when we had the markets running a couple years ago, it was in all these high-flying names. People were simply riding these much riskier stocks because, you know what, there's a lot of momentum players out there. But there has been this general shift that we've seen of investors moving more into either income or almost safer type of investments, not looking so much just for that capital gains aspect. Can you maybe discuss what this means in terms of overall market makeup and the importance of the shift that we have seen here?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And I mean, a lot of that, of course, is because now people have the memory of the last quarter of last year, which was pretty painful for a lot of investors, particularly if they were on margin in some of these high flyers. And yeah, there's definitely a shift. And I think in this sort of leg, if you like, of a bull market, we're much more likely to see more differentiation between various stocks or among various stocks. And part of it is the more risky high flyers versus income. But I think some of it is just going to be which particular sectors or even individual stocks are doing well. And, in the earnings season that's coming up, I suspect I suspect some companies that underperform are going to be hit very hard. One of the things that's true in the broad market as well as in the resource sector, we were talking about the resources earlier, but it's also true in the broad sector. I think the market is no longer shrugging off bad news. When you have bad news, whatever it is, whether it's earnings or the jury cases in Roundup or, Elon Musk criticizing the SEC again, although I'm kind of conflicted on that because I think Tesla is a great short, but I also like it anytime anybody sticks it to the SEC. But that's a different issue. But anytime there's bad news, the stocks are actually responding quite sharply, as opposed to, say, a year ago when bad news was largely just ignored. And we've seen that, as I say, with three different types of bad news that I've mentioned, but each one hit the stock involved very heavily, more heavily than perhaps the fundamentals would dictate. And so I think that suggests that investors are being more selective, and they're being, although they're buying stocks, they're being much more risk-averse than they were a year ago.
All right, some interesting comments there, Adrian, but now let's also switch over to the resource sector. It's one of the reasons why I read your newsletter. And I have to say that we have seen a selective recovery in some of these stocks. And some of the stocks that you and I were chatting about off mic, they range anywhere from royalty companies to producers or near-term producers to exploration companies. What do you think investors need to be most aware of when looking at different resource companies and trying to figure out whether to invest? Because they do see some stocks bucking the trend, but in a broad sense, there's a lot of stocks still lagging.
Definitely, a lot of stocks are lagging. I think overall, there has been some green sprouts, as they say. There have been some signs of strength in some of these markets as bids coming in. But again, and I'll get to your question in a second if I may, but again, any bad news, the stocks are being punished very, very hard. And we've seen that with several stocks recently. Mandora would be a good example, where they had disappointing results from their joint venture with Freeport, and the stock, has tumbled 50%, basically. So we've seen this, and I think we're going to continue to see this. There'd be very few high flyers, on the other hand. It's just a matter of overall strength across the board, but not very few that have been, exceptional performers. But I think a couple of things. To me, number one, it comes down to, two things, really. One is the people and one is the balance sheet. Both of those are just absolutely, absolutely critical, in my view, with juniors. And, we talked earlier, you mentioned, the number of companies that have raised money this year, although some of them kind of struggled to close, and that's absolutely true. I mean, I think in February and March, we did more private placements in such a short period of time than I've ever done, in the last 30 years. There were a lot of them and a lot of good ones, good companies. But as we did one and then another and then another, we sort of started to run out of money. And I think that's happening with the whole market. So not only did some individual companies that perhaps weren't so attractive have difficulties raising money, but equally there's just so much of it for the whole sector to absorb. And the person who's putting $100,000 into a private placement is probably not putting that $100,000 into other companies in the market. And so the number of private placements that have, you know, money that's been raised, including the flow-throughs in Canada, has removed some liquidity from other stocks, from publicly traded stocks. But, you know, the good companies have still been able to raise money on reasonable terms. I don't know if you saw the Orion one. They did a financing and closed it very successfully, and there's been several of those. But I think companies that did not raise money in the early part of the year and are still going to need to raise money over the next 6 months, they could maybe have a little bit more difficulty unless they have something very significant going on. So anyway, the main thing to me is balance sheet. Do they have the capital to execute their plans for the next, you know, year or two? And equally, are they putting a reasonable percentage of their money into the ground or into their activities rather than into G&A? Because companies that are putting 75% of their money into G&A over the last several years, they're going to have a more difficult time raising money going forward. I think more and more people are scrutinizing these things a little more carefully than they ever have in the past, which is a good thing.
Yeah, as well they should be. That's something you and
Absolutely.
I have talked about too, is the fact that you do need to watch very closely where money is being spent. But you also bring up a good point about that little financing window that we've seen in the last about 3 to 4 months where companies have been able to raise some money. Obviously, not every company has been able to raise the money, but we have seen some oversubscribed private placements. Something to consider is that does also lock up those funds for 4 months, and that takes that money away from buying in the public in the open market. So that could be a sign of maybe a bit of a slower time coming for the broad number of stocks. Adrian, can you share some of the stocks that are catching your eye right now that maybe our listeners can look into, please?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, one right now to look at would be Midland. It's the exploration company focused in Quebec. MD is the symbol. I've mentioned it before in the show, I'm sure. I should mention our firm, our clients own, I'm not quite sure, but it's over 15% anyway. So we're a big shareholder of Midland. I've mentioned it. I followed it for a long, 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 long time. They follow the prospect generator joint venture model primarily in Quebec, very well financed. They've got about $12 million in cash at the moment. But they have just started exploring a property that they discovered last September, October through grab samples. And they didn't have time before winter to do any more serious work. So it was just grab samples, but the grab samples were extremely attractive. Now they've done geophysics, they've done soil testing, and now they've just started drilling. Drill program is underway. Now, I mean, obviously, the truth machine will tell us whether this property, which is called Murthrill, up in James Bay, that will tell us whether, you know, there's something there or not. But certainly the geophysics have looked very attractive, and the soil anomalies have been very attractive. We know that these things don't always work out. We saw what happened with Evrim and his Qualy property, where they had extremely disappointing results that nobody was really expecting. So these things can go bad. I think the good thing, you know, I would say about Midland is at $1.25, you're really not paying a lot. You're really not paying a lot for this particular property. If they have a discovery here, the stock, you know, is easily a $2 stock in my mind. So you're not overpaying for it. And you, in the meantime, you've got good people, good balance sheet, lots of other projects, you know, etc. So that's one that I like, and we've been buying that one, I should say. You know, we own a lot, but we've also been buying the last few days. And since I mentioned Evram, maybe I should just say everything I said about Midland in terms of quality of the people, strong balance sheet, lots of other properties and activities is true of Evram. Evram, when they had the disappointing results at Quali, you know, it just really it just really fell much further than it should have done. And so what you've got at the moment is a company selling for $25 million Canadian, $25 million, with about 11.5 million probably now in cash. Plus, they have a 2% royalty on a property called Ermitaño, which is right next door to First Majestic Santa Elena project. Santa Elena is running out of ore. The property was sold to First Majestic. First Majestic is drilling that property very aggressively because they want the ore. They just announced an update to their maiden resource estimate. Resources are up 20% in the last year. I think you're going to see them start producing that as soon as they possibly can, because they, you know, they need it. They've got a facility there. And anyway, from the point of view of Evram, that's a royalty that could be sold anytime they want. Right, royalties are very, very attractive in this market. So they could pick up the phone, make four phone calls, and have it sold. How much would they get? I don't know. But I can tell you this much, that 25 million market cap and 12 million of cash, they will get at least 13 million, which means that these two assets alone are the market cap of the company. So everything else they have, you know, regional alliance with Newmont, very innovative project with Yamana. They're going through Yamana's old database, and they have the right to present projects to Yamana for a joint venture. And if Yamana doesn't want them, they can keep them. That's a very, very attractive kind of deal. So there's lots going on with Evram. Very, very cheap at 30 cents. Very cheap. Metalla is one we've talked about before. It's obviously doing very well, but Metalla is a royalty company, junior royalty company. It's only been around about 2.5 years. Brett Heath, the CEO and the founder of the company and the CEO, has done, in my view, an amazing job building a company, a solid company, so quickly. They recently issued a $12 million convertible loan, and at the same time, or the same day, they announced that they had purchased a package of 18 royalties from Alamos. They bought these in shares of the company, which means that the convertible they raised is obviously for something else. So, you know, this is a company that has half a dozen producing. By the end of the year, they'll have half a dozen producing royalties, mostly at the moment, mostly in silver, but increasingly some of the Alamos ones are gold. They have a strong balance sheet, $12 million they just raised. And interestingly, for a junior, they pay a dividend. The dividend right now is about 1.4%. So for the gold space, that's a high. That's on the high end of dividend yields, as you probably know, for the gold space. It's very unusual for a junior to pay a dividend. I have to say that I told Brett I was against them paying a dividend because I thought it was better for them to preserve their cash for deals, because it's a growing company. But his point, which I fully understand, is that paying a dividend tells the market that the cash flow is sustainable, that it's not a one-off, that this is, you know, that the company has grown to the point where they can justify a dividend, and that they believe that dividend payment is sustainable. So, you know, Metalla, it's had a good run. If you follow it, you know, 80 cents at the beginning of the year, $1.32 today, had a good run on the back of not just the news I mentioned, but on a couple of other items of good news. I think this is one that, you know, we just hold it, and we hold what we own. With new clients, we buy it, and we're just holding on to it. I think in 3 to 5 years, you know, this will be a $5 stock. It'll be bought by one of the other royalty companies, in my view. That's the sort of end game. Someone else will buy it. But in the meantime, you're getting a dividend. Very, very well-run company. So I can't say enough about the way they run this company.
Okay. Well, Adrian, that gives our listeners at least a little bit of companies or a couple companies to look into. And you know what? I have had Brett on the show a couple of times to explain the Mentala royalty strategy. And so far, they're executing on that very nicely, as you have outlined. Adrian, it's great to have you on the show. Thank you for sharing your thoughts on the broad averages, as well as diving down into some of those resource companies that you like. If anybody wants more information on Adrian and Adrian Day Asset Management, feel free to email me, fleck@kereport.com. In the meantime, Adrian, have a great rest of your weekend.
Well, and you, and thank you very much for having me, Corey.
To find out more about today's guests, visit us on the web at www.kereport.com. You're listening to the Corlin Economics Report. We'll be back in a moment. Providing unique reporting on markets and companies since 1990. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
Oh, welcome back. Continuing to listen to the first hour of the weekend edition, and I hope everybody enjoyed that slightly then longer segment with Adrian Day. In this segment, I am chatting with Dana Lyons, fund manager based out of Chicago. And Dana, let's start off by talking about these U.S. equity markets, because I really do think that this is the story that everybody needs to be watching as these markets continue to trend higher, looking to break out to new all-time highs. But even some of the conversations I had this week, and even on Friday with Chris Kimball, as he pointed out, the recovery, especially in the tech sector, has been broad-based. We're not seeing just a few isolated stocks or sectors lead these markets higher. What do you have to say about still what seems like the path of least resistance for the U.S. markets is higher?
Yeah, that's correct, Corey. We saw, obviously, off the December low, we saw what they term a breadth thrust. It's just extraordinarily wide participation in that bounce off of the low, which almost invariably suggests longer term gains. So we saw a nice, healthy consolidation at the end of February for about a month or so. Saw small caps, broad indices run into resistance right where they should have. But following about 4 or 5 weeks of consolidation, we saw over the last, 2 weeks, we've seen a nice, healthy, strong bounce off of there. Broad and small cap measures overcoming resistance, and they look to be pretty much lining up the next leg in this rally from those December lows. At the same time, obviously, you see the large caps have, at the same time, did slow down in their pace. After that late February top, if you will, but they've continued on their way, and it doesn't look like there's anything preventing them from at least testing those highs from last year, and likely maybe after a short consolidation, probably moving to new highs.
So does this change the overall outlook to a more bullish playbook? I know you and I have been chatting about reading or playing off of a more bearish playbook, but now with the strength we're seeing in the markets, is there a change coming?
I think that maybe just the timetable of it. I think after that, the breadth thrust and the participation that we saw in the early part of the rally, that changed somewhat the expectations for this rally. Right now, obviously, the large caps look like they are poised to test and go to new highs. But we would not still would not dismiss the possibility that in the broad market that the fourth quarter was the first shot, the first salvo in a possible longer term bear market. They still have lots to prove. The broad markets issues I'm referring to, and the indices still have much to prove as far as long term getting back to new highs and extending the long-term bear market or bull market, excuse me. So the jury's still out on that. Would not throw out the idea that we did start a broad-based bear market in the fourth quarter, but in the near term, in the intermediate term, nothing to tell us that this up leg is over. This intermediate term rally post December is over. So right now the trend is up, and we continue to ride that and continue to buy dips.
So Dana, do you consider at all that already this year we have something like the S&P up 15%? That's a pretty good 1 year move for the broad average, the S&P, rather than just a 3.5 to 4 month move.
Yeah, true, but you have to look at where they where they're coming from. We were deeply oversold, historically oversold at the end of December. So half of that move is probably just reverting, wiping out some of those the excessively oversold levels and reverting back to the mean to some extent. So it has been an impressive start to the year, but that's the danger of using calendar points as your point of reference. It depends where you're coming from in terms of where you're starting your rally and where you're starting your performance measures, because the calendar doesn't necessarily line up with key junctures in the market. So yes, it's been impressive, but we were very oversold coming into the year.
Very good point. And I think sometimes people get a little too stuck on certain time frames or looking at too short term of charts. But you are right. That sell off at the end of the year did bring the markets into extreme oversold positions. Now, also, what about the fact that if we do see, say, the S&P break to all-time highs, do you think that brings in even more trend and momentum followers with almost that FOMO mentality that could drive the markets even higher after that break happens?
You're probably right. It's going to draw in more money either way, whether it's smart money trend followers that's going to push it and extend it sustainably higher is another question. You're certainly going to get Johnny come latelys to the rally, and we see investors of all stripes usually chasing price. So whether it's down and selling at the bottom or chasing prices higher, chasing breakouts, you're going to see that. Whether that ends up being a good move or not, and how long that move is extended, it remains to be seen. But certainly breakouts will suck more money into the market.
All right, let's move focus and talk a little bit about the bond market. Bonds had a nice rally at the tail end of last year and even into this year, driving yields lower. But we've seen a little bit of pullback in terms of bonds, and that's helped yields move slightly higher. Still, the yields are still very much at a low range, though. What do you think about the opportunities that the bond market might be presenting after this couple-week sell-off?
We've discussed many times our view on the long-term interest rate cycle. We think it had bottomed, that some 60-year cycle bottomed in the summer of 2016. So we think rates generally are going up for probably the next several decades. That said, on an intermediate term basis, bonds are still in a rally mode. And I think there's still, especially in the 10-year, still a little bit more downside to go in yields, upside in prices. So for the moment, in the near term, I think any pullbacks in price, any bounces in yields are probably represent dips to be bought. So we would continue even in the short term here, buying dips and bonds as well.
Okay, so you're saying that even with this recent pullback, this could be an opportunity because, again, I guess kind of with the U.S. equity markets, you're also seeing the path of least resistance for the bond market as being up.
Correct. I would take this recent bump up in yields, I would take that as a buying opportunity in the bond market.
All right, let's also move over to commodities in general. You recently posted a chart that outlined where the commodity sector is or where it was going, unfortunately still in this pretty long-term downtrend dating the whole way back to about 2008 or 2009. A recent test of this downtrend line is occurring right now. How do you think this all plays out?
Similar to bonds, although it's not as consistent in the longer term cycle. But longer term, the trend is still lower, I think, in commodities, in the broad-based commodity indices, and probably in crude as well. That said, in the intermediate term, obviously, the trend is up. So until that, at least in crude oil, is up. So the benefit of the doubt is still the upside. But I think we would argue that probably that intermediate term bounce, that post-December bounce in crude oil, has just about run its course. So we'd certainly be taking a long exposure off the table in crude oil at this point. And generally, we'd be sellers of major rallies in the commodity market, and expecting over the long term, expecting more of a downward move in commodities than anything to the upside.
Now, could you see if, let's say, oil does pull back after this run that, in all fairness, has gone on longer than a lot of people thought, do you see that putting at least a little bit of a damper on those U.S. markets?
That could be a proximate cause for some sort of a pullback or a pause or consolidation. I'm not sure. I think a lot of the certainly saw some correlation in terms of the sell-off last year in the fourth quarter. It came down to probably a little bit of a liquidity issue where people started selling everything. But I wouldn't necessarily count out the equity market, even if crude oil does top out soon and start to pull back. I wouldn't say that's a death knell for the stock market rally by any means.
All right, let's wrap it up with a couple comments on the precious metals and the miners. The precious metals have had a decent run, but again, no significant breakouts. Now more just trading at kind of the upper part of this range, but you can argue this range has been in play for upwards of 5 years. So it's hard to, I guess, jump on board with a market that is still not really showing any breakup or breakdown. What do you think about the setup right now of where the metals are and where the miners stand?
I think probably the benefit of the doubt is probably still with the upside. I don't think the risk-reward opportunity is that great. Certainly better on the upside than the downside, I guess. In terms of the miners, I think they're testing support right now. So if you want to get in there and buy the dip, I would not be averse to doing so in the gold miners right here. I think probably they have marginal upside above their recent highs during this 4-5 month rally that we've seen in gold miners. So I think there's probably they do have potential for a little bit marginal more upside. So I'd be not averse to buying right here, but I wouldn't have I would do so with outrageous expectations for the upside. So buy the dip, yeah. Don't think it's long-term play for us necessarily, but maybe some more marginal upside.
Okay. Well, we're going to wrap it up there, Dana. It's always great having you on the show. I appreciate all of your comments, and I appreciate you taking time over the weekend to share all these markets that we have discussed today. Dana, have a great rest of your weekend, and everybody stick around. I'm going to be right back to wrap up the show with Jeff Christian. Thanks, Dana.
Thanks, Corey.
Welcome back here to wrap up the first hour of the weekend edition. I am wrapping up this hour with Jeff Christian. He is the managing partner over at the CPM Group. We're going to be focusing a lot on resource and precious metals sectors, but we're also going to be talking kind of in a broad sense of what some of these more overwhelming issues are for this sector. First, though, Jeff, it feels like every day we wake up, we look at the markets, and throughout the day we're looking at the metals markets, and what we continue to see is range-bound moves. This week was a great example of gold moving slightly higher, just above 1,300, and then at the end of the week, or middle to tail end of the week, dropping below 1,300, and quite frankly, you pull up that monthly chart, and you see this boring range-bound sideways trade that the metals have been in for a long time now. Have you ever seen any other metals markets that are similar to this time frame where it's just been a boring sideways move?
Yeah, we have seen it. You know, late 1983, 84, we saw this kind of becalmed gold and silver prices. We saw it again in 1995, 1996, into early 1997, where the markets become sort of range bound. And I guess if you look at those two periods and maybe the current period, one of the things that you see is they're mid-cycle economically. Yeah, so we've had a recession in each case. We come out of the recession. Precious metals and other commodities were recovering. They got to a certain point. We're halfway through the economic expansion, and you just sort of get into this Sargasso Sea of quietness that, you know, takes a while to break out of. And so we have seen it before, and we'll probably see it again.
What caused the markets to break after those other times that you just mentioned of those sideways moves?
Yeah, you know, I have to admit that I'm not quite too clear on what was going on in 84, 85, 86. But I do know that, you know, you had sort of a shift in attitudes toward the dollar, which was rising at the time. And it continued to rise for a couple of years, but people were starting to say, wait a second, the dollar's too high, it's too strong. And you started to see some people cycling out of commodities. So you had a dip down, and then you had the prices come back up more sharply in 85, 86, 87. And you know, in 95, 96, 97, the gold price was pretty much range bound, as was silver. And then you had the BREX scandal, and that pushed gold prices down for several years before they started rising again. You know, ultimately they've risen as you got into the late stages of an economic cycle and investors started cycling out of stocks and bonds into gold and silver.
So what about the U.S. dollar, though? You bring up a good point there, where right now we are still hearing people say the U.S. dollar is too high, but it's not in the 100 level on the dollar index. What's your outlook?
Our outlook is that the dollar probably will be sideways, kind of volatile, with an upward bend. And the upward inclination reflects the fact that, you know, and this has changed too. Let me back up. We think that the dollar is sort of where it was in 1984 in terms of cyclicality, in that, yeah, there are a lot of people starting to say, hey, this thing looks like it's top heavy and it could come down. But the reality is that it could go up for another, you know, 12, 15 months before you start to see it go down, which is what happened back then. One of the things that we're watching with the dollar is, up until this year, the Fed was liquidating its bond portfolio. And when it does that, that sucks dollars out of circulation. Now, because there's so much debt in the world, not just the U.S. government debt, but private debt and other governments' debt that's denominated in dollars, the debtors need dollars to service that debt. And what we saw was, you know, maybe a 10% decline in the Fed's balance sheet over the last year and a half. And that was sucking out, you know, several hundred billion dollars worth of dollars from circulation. And that was one of the factors that's been pushing the gold, the dollar exchange rate up, was that debtors needed a flow of dollars in order to service their debt. Now, the Fed has said that it's pulling back from reducing its balance sheet and raising interest rates, at least for a while. So that could put cap on the dollar. But insofar as the dollar, you know, represents 62% of monetary reserves held by governments and probably 75% of private sector wealth, there's a need for the dollar that will keep the dollar higher and possibly move it somewhat higher yet before we see it come down sometime down the road.
All right, Jeff, let's also talk about something you and I were chatting about off mic, and that is the problem with the metals trading side of things. Some of these issues transcend just simply the fundamentals of these actual metals. Can you share some of the details, what you've been talking to some of these other groups that are looking at these metal sectors?
Yeah, you know, I think the regulatory environment is really causing problems, not just for the metals industry, but across industries. And we're seeing that in various sectors. So, for example, as I was saying off mic, you know, we were talking to the jewelry manufacturers, and they have a real problem because the U.S. government has this rule that says if you can't certify that the gold in your jewelry was mined in America, you know, you bought it from a refinery, where did that refinery get the metal? You have no idea, oh, you know, that gold might, have been in Cleopatra's, you know, rings 5,000 years ago or 3,000 years ago. You know, you don't know where that gold's coming from. You can't say that that jewelry was made in America. So we were talking to the jewelry industry, and they were having these problems with gold and silver. And, you know, our point is it's not just jewelry. It's not just gold and silver. This made in America rule that the United States is living under, which is much more severe than the rest of the world is living under. The rest of the world has reached an agreement that allows people to continue to do business. But the U.S. has taken a much stern, more stern and comprehensive and restrictive regulation. And so it's kind of grinding the jewelry industry to a halt. And what our comment was, you have to step outside of the jewelry industry and get like the National Association of Manufacturers to complain about it, which has happened in the past. But you're seeing, you know, increased regulations on the financial markets, both on the buy side and on the sell side. And you're finding institutional investors like afraid to talk to people. We're finding, you know, we have one client that sells our research to institutional investors, and they've become so overly protective to make sure that they don't wind up providing inside information that they are having trouble getting consultants like CPM Group allowing us to talk to their clients, because, you know, CPM Group talks to people around the world throughout the precious metals industries, from producers to refiners to users to investors, and people have to rely on our integrity and our ethics to not tell them confidential information. And we have a 40-year record of doing that and maintaining confidences long beyond when we were legally responsible to continue doing so. But there's this legalistic tendency to say, no, we just can't trust anybody's ethics anymore. So therefore, this consultant who knows stuff about these markets must not speak to our institutional investor clients. And you're finding this, you know, across the board. We have one of the largest precious metals hedge funds. It took them 6 months to open an account just to buy gold on a standard, you know, T+2 basis, where, you know, I'll agree to buy gold from you. I, you know, on day one, I wire your money to your bank account on day two. You get the money and you release the gold on day three. On day three, the third, you know, the second day after we've made the trade. And it took them 6 months to open that account with a major refinery, you know, being a major hedge fund. So what you're finding is that transactions are becoming more expensive and more difficult to undertake. And people are getting frustrated and just walking away.
It really seems like this is going in the wrong direction. If we want a more sustainable, even bull market, or just to get more investors into the metals, there need to be some changes in the opposite direction of the way that they have been going. Do you see this happening? Is there any light at the end of the tunnel here?
You know, there's got to be a way to resolve it. I don't know how we get from where we are to where we were. You know, I always talk about, you know, Dodd-Frank's was like 5,000 or 6,000 pages. Sarbanes-Oxley was 5,000 pages. The Commodities Trade Act of 1974 was an enormous legalistic document that was confusing to everybody, and it's still confusing to everybody. When we created the SEC in 1933, I think it was about a 5-page piece of legislation, which basically said, don't trade on inside information. Don't screw your clients. Don't screw anybody else. And by the way, we're hiring Joe Kennedy Sr. to run the SEC, and he knows every trick in the book, so he's going to be watching. You know, and that's ultimately where you've got to get to. You've got to get to practical, effective regulations. I mean, the regulations that we have now, like my client who can't trust us to talk to clients and not divulge inside information, all of his regulations don't do anything to protect him and his clients from somebody who wants to give them inside information, because that person will just lie. If he's not ethical, he's going to lie. You know, so none of this regulation actually is effective, but it's cumbersome. So it's squashing business, it's reducing the ability to do business, and it's really not protecting the public at all from the kinds of misfeasance and malfeasance that led to 2007, 2009.
So how does this leave, or where does this leave the like retail investor, the little guy in this? It sounds like there's stuff going very much against them. So kind of hard for the little guy to win out, isn't it?
The little guy is up on the hill watching the fires burn in the valley. I mean, that and that's probably where he's always been, and that's where he is today. You know, he's just sort of watching this and saying, yeah, okay, not even the really big institutional investors can get quality information and make informed decisions. What am I supposed to do?
Yeah, it's disappointing, isn't it? But now, Jeff, one thing that the CPM Group did put out recently was how precious metals, this could be a year to accumulate. Can you share some more information on why you released that?
Well, that goes back to what we were talking about at the very beginning. You know, we're in this doldrums now. We're I use the term, I think, Sargasso Sea, but you know, we're in the horse latitudes where the price of gold's trading between 1280 and 1330, 1350. And our view is that, yes, it could come down. It could go down to 1250. There are people who are looking at a head and shoulders pattern and saying it could go down to 1215 in the second and third quarters of this year. But we take a longer-term view at gold and at silver and at platinum right now. And we're saying, look, from a long-term perspective, you know, 1280, 1300, even 1250, you know, all of these prices seem to be incredibly low from where we think the price is going to be 5-10 years from now. And silver is, you know, trading around $15 for, you know, it broke below $15 yesterday and it's below $15 as we speak. You know, that's probably a pretty good price to accumulate if you're a long-term investor. You might see lower prices 6 months from now, but you might see higher prices 12 months, 2 years, 5 years from now. So, you know, from our perspective, if you're a long-term investor, a buy and hold type of guy, these may be very attractive levels at which to buy and hold the metal, or as you say, accumulate the metal and add to your portfolio. Not only because gold, silver, platinum prices look cheap, but also because the dollar and the stock market and the bond market all look pricey. And a lot of those economic and political and financial market factors that cause instability, that cause gold and silver prices to rise, they're there. They're getting bigger. They're not likely to whack the market, we think, in the next 6 to 12 months, but at some point they will. And when that happens, gold and silver prices will rise sharply. And you won't want to be buying them as the price rises. You want to buy them now while the price is dead and investors are saying, I don't want this stuff.
All right, Jeff, we're going to wrap it up there. It's always great having you on the show, and I hope everybody enjoyed this first hour. If you want to get in touch, please email me, fleck@kereport.com. I love hearing from all of you, our listeners. Please share with me any trading ideas that you have, any companies you want me to look into, and always listen to those company interviews that I have every week, which are also outlined at the bottom of the posting for the weekend show. Jeff, great chatting with you. Thank you for all you do for the CPM Group, and thank you for sharing your insights in the resource sector. Have a great rest of your weekend there, Jeff.
For our upcoming appearance schedule, visit kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back in just a moment.